Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of Our Memphis History. I'm Mark White. This focus for the show is going to be Elmwood Cemetery, and we've got two excellent guests for you today. Kim Bearden, who's the CEO and Executive Director of Elmwood, and her husband Willie Bearden. Willie's a preeminent Memphis filmmaker, whose work you've no doubt seen around Memphis, even the Memphis Memoirs series on PBS. He's done part of that. It's wonderful shows. You can read more about both Kim and Willie on our show notes and the OurMemphisHistory.com website. Today we're going to talk about how the cemetery came into existence, and you'll hear some familiar names of Memphians and people from around the world who've been laid to rest there. Listen closely, you may be able to hear the train that comes through at the edge of the grounds, and a little bit more about that later. So let's listen in as our very own Joe Lowry speaks with Kim and Willie.
Hi, my name is Kim Bearden. I'm the Executive Director of Elmwood Cemetery.
And I am Willie Bearden. I am Mr. Kim, I guess you could call. And I am a writer and a filmmaker in Memphis.
And I'm Joe Lowry, and I co-produce OurMemphisHistory.com. And I'm with two friends of mine, and Willie and I have known each other since we were in college together, about 1971.
So that's right.
We go way back.
Almost 50 years, Joe.
Yes, and we get together, and it's like old home week. It's just one of those fun things. We're at probably, in my opinion, the richest treasure that we have. When we talk about Memphis history, this is the richest, the best of the best. When we're dealing with everything to do with Memphis history, it is all here. And I'm with two experts. My first question, why was Elmwood established?
And we look at each other and decide who's going to go first.
That's right. I say you go.
I say I go first, too.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so Elmwood was established because real estate in downtown Memphis was a prized commodity at the time, leading up to the years that Elmwood was established in 1852. There was people were beginning to see that the area was going to be crowded, and they felt, they being the real estate folks who basically ran downtown, ran Memphis, they felt that the land could be put to better use, for building structures. So they got their friends together and decided that they would look for land outside of the city limits. And this was about 1850. And then in 1852, 50 Memphis businessmen put together $500 each, and they purchased the cemetery land. And that was the original 40-acre portion of the cemetery. Some years later, they added an additional 40 acres, and so now we have the current layout of the cemetery, 80 acres. The cemetery was also established because it was part of the blossoming rural cemetery movement that we're going to talk about in just a few minutes, but that's basically why the cemetery was founded. And I'm glad that it was. To get here was a very purposeful act. So, there was eventually a rail car that would bring you out to the cemetery. I think it was the Red Line. The Elmwood Line was the Red Line.
Okay.
It was called the Elmwood Line. And the cemetery founders paid to have it brought to the cemetery. But if you didn't catch the streetcar, then of course you had to either walk the 2.5 miles from downtown, or you had to get your mule-drawn wagon and ride to the cemetery. I can't imagine it would have been anything less than very bumpy and uncomfortable. But the joy of being out, having been established out in the countryside, is that we still have some trees that are here on the property that were there before the cemetery was founded. So we have some 300-year-old trees here. Yeah, it's really, really amazing to me that, because, in our day and age, we have these housing developments, these suburbs. I live in the suburbs, so I'm not knocking the suburbs, but, you have developers who go in and, you clear cut every tree first. You level the ground. Well, they didn't do that here. And as a result, what you get are these beautiful sweeping vistas and rolling hills and these trees that are holding it all together, I think. So it's a pretty magical place. And that is not exactly what you asked me, but that's what I think.
Well, and I think another thing, that speaks to is that people saw that Memphis was gonna do all right. you know, that it was going to actually stick around a little bit, and that it was growing to the point where they needed to free up those places that were being used as burial grounds in what we now know as downtown Memphis.
And there were several.
Yes, right.
We had a cemetery on what was called Bass Avenue, which was later Jefferson, mm-hmm. and Hubbard Place, which is about where Pauline hits Poplar.
Yeah.
We had the old Winchester Cemetery, and we had individual cemeteries in different places.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I guess that was probably before, about the time that they created this.
Yeah, and with those cemeteries, you know, the Morris Cemetery was down where the train station, you know, down on South Main, and the train station, the arcade and everything, Samara Cemetery, and all of those people were disinterred and brought to Elmwood. So you might see, like, as you wander through, you know, the rolling hills here, you might see some people whose death date is in the 1840s, you know, or in the 1850s before Elmwood was an active cemetery. And that also comes along because when people used to move, if you were moving your family from, say, North Carolina or East Tennessee and coming out here to what was the frontier, a lot of times you would dig up Meemaw and Pawpaw and put them in the wagon, you know, their caskets in the wagon, and bring them with you because you knew you weren't going back. And so a lot of people got buried like that. They were taking people along. I mean, that was a very common thing, wasn't it, Kim?
It wasn't unusual, that's for sure. People moved folks around, and when I say folks, I mean those who are deceased, moved folks around at a greater clip back then than they do now. Of course, it's these days, there are health department regulations, and you have to get funeral home directors involved and all that kind of stuff. So it's cost prohibitive. But it still happens sometimes, you know, folks get moved around. You know, case in point, we've got an American Revolutionary War veteran buried here. He was buried originally at the Winchester Cemetery, you know, and I find it interesting, his daughter married Isaac Shelby's son. And so she married into the Shelby family, for whom Shelby County is named. Little, yeah. You know, but that's why we have an American Revolutionary War veteran buried here at Elmwood. Obviously, he died well before the cemetery was established. Another case in point, the Graham family. You know, they are the people that had a farm that turned into Grahamwood Elementary School. And so when they built the school, they disinterred them and brought them out here to Elmwood. Their tablets date to 1833. So that's, I think, the earliest that we found in the cemetery.
They were in the wagon business.
Oh, were they?
They owned a very large Graham wagon company.
Oh, interesting.
They made wagons for everybody.
Okay.
They made even wagons for the police and the fire department.
Interesting.
They were like the Lilly Carriage Company. They made wagons for the police and fire.
Wow.
Whatever you think about it, everybody had to have a wagon back then.
That's right.
Certainly they
that's
did.
That's right.
Yeah.
Harness makers, and, you know, you start thinking about all the... You know, you talk about the businesses and the industries that get disrupted today. You know, we hear a lot about, you know, well, the taxi cab industry has been disrupted by Lyft and Uber and things like that. But that's always going on.
Yeah,
you
remember
know?
Phone books? Remember good old phone books?
Oh, phone books, yeah. Right, yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, what is that? And you know, I do talks, I have a slide of a payphone, and I've shown it to some kids before. They had no idea what it was. You know, you could be, you know, you 30 years ago, you could find a phone, a payphone on every block, basically, in front of every store. And I guarantee you, you'd be hard pressed to find one in an hour driving around Memphis. I know where maybe there's one. But you know, that's all gone, and I think we get nostalgic about, you know, the things that used to be, but you know, we've always torn things down. You know, industries have always been disrupted.
I know that on the south end of the property down there, there used to be houses.
Yeah, there was a house down there, that's right, and it was torn down sometime in the 1950s, the early 50s. The folks who ran the cemetery at that time funnily put it in the newspaper that they would give the house away to anybody who would come and move it. I can't imagine that moving a house was at any point in mankind's history easy.
Is that on a piece of property that is cleared?
No.
When you come out from Neptune and Walker and you look east, in fact, when I came in there today, because the Neptune side of this thing is the way the fire department comes through. When I was on the job, we knew we don't bring anything across that bridge.
Yeah.
Everything comes in and from on the Neptune side.
That's right. Yeah, because there's an 8-ton limit on the bridge. That's right.
Yeah, so I came in that way and I've shot pictures of the barn. And how long is the barn and how long has the little house been there?
You know, the barn was built in 1901 and I love that. It's my favorite structure here at Elmwood. It's so neat to go in there and just kind of imagine what running the cemetery was like in the early days. And I say the early days, it was obviously built 50 years after the cemetery was founded. There may have even been another structure there at one time. I don't know. But I love that barn. It feels old. You go in and you look up and it's got a high pitch to it. And we recently did some restoration work to the cupola and it's just a beautiful structure. The house, I'm not sure when the house was built down there. It's been there for a really long time. Been there for 1, 2, 3, a lot years. That's how long it's been there. I just don't know. We keep having to patch it and paint it and fix it. And we've got somebody who lives in it. We've got somebody who lives on the property and takes care of it.
My next question is, this is still an active cemetery.
Yes, we perform about 200 burials a year. So, you know, that's well below, you know, of your bigger, more commercial cemeteries in town, I guess I should say. That's well below what they would say. But for a small, very old cemetery, I'm just so honored that people continue to trust us and come back here and be buried and become a part of the story of Elmwood.
This is the kind of place that, for me, if I want to just, I want peace and quiet, and I just want to kind of get my thoughts together, you can just come in here and park, go find a bench and sit there and just, and know that you're safe to even as crime ridden as our city is, this is a safe place.
It is. I feel very safe here. Thank you for saying that. I mean, I've worked here for 22 years this year and I've never had an issue. Now, that's not to say that things have not happened in the cemetery, but they happen anywhere. I feel very comfortable walking around the cemetery by myself. It feels very much like you're stepping out. I mean, immediately, as soon as you enter the grounds, it feels like you're stepping back in time in a very sacred space.
Have y'all ever heard anything about any ghosts?
You know,
I am super cynical.
I know. I'm so, like, gosh. Here's my answer. So my official answer, I'll tell you my official and my unofficial answer. So my official answer is no, of course not, because I don't believe in ghosts. Okay, so here's my unofficial answer. I feel the more I say, tell the story, the more foolish I feel. But here's what happened. So I was here, God, what year is this? 2019? It must have been 5, 6 years ago now. And back then I would give, and I still do, periodically in the warmer months, I will give a tour on Friday evenings of the cemetery. So they may start at 6 or 6:30. So instead of leaving work, I'll just lock myself in the building and I'll just wait for the tour to start. What's the point in leaving? So I was here one Friday evening by myself and it was probably, I mean, it wasn't late. It was like maybe 5:30, but I was the only person on the property. And I was walking from the front of my office building to back to my office. And I heard somebody whistling, and the hairs just stood up on the back of my neck. Now, after I chilled out, I was like, well, obviously somebody has walked over the bridge or something. And I looked around, peeked out the windows. There was nobody here. It was just me. So it wasn't a scary whistling. It was rather friendly, but it... Now I feel foolish.
What song were they whistling?
It was nothing that I knew. Just a happy tune.
Something old, like a ghost would know.
I don't know. Maybe. Oh. I don't. I don't know. I still. I don't want to admit it to myself that it really happened. Kind of because I feel like if I do, then that's acknowledging that there are ghosts, and ghosts scare me.
Do you have to be rich
To be buried here? No, you do not have to be rich to be buried here. You don't have to be anything but a person who wants to come here and be buried. We are open to people from all walks of life, always have been. We have a lot of Memphis history that sort of spans the pocketbook, if you will. So we have the poorest and the richest of Memphis history found here.
And I think probably the big difference in Elmwood is that Elmwood was really the first institution of its kind in this part of the country that really started embracing the stories here. I mean, you know, it is a part of the rural cemetery movement, which we will talk about. But I think going right along with that is when you look out through these grounds, you see people's personalities shining through in a big way after they're dead. It's, you know, I mean, there are many cemeteries that you get the same plaque that everybody does, and that's fine. It's very easy to mow those kinds of cemeteries. I always say it's very hard to mow history, you know. So everything you see around here is because somebody said, this is how I want to be remembered after I'm gone. And I think one of the most important things is they say that you die twice. The first time when you leave this mortal plane and you are, you know, no longer inhabiting your earthly body. But the last time and the final time that you die is when the last person who knew your name, the last person who knew your story, it's when they pass away. So what we try to do here, and I'm speaking, you know, just as a volunteer here, somebody who does tours and lectures and things like that, and I do love the cemetery, but, you know, people can stay alive for a long, long time, and we keep finding people out here and finding their incredibly important stories. And, you know, and all of these things really together make up the Memphis story. So I like it that Elmwood has made it's in their basic principles here to keep people's stories alive.
You mentioned the rural cemetery movement. I've never heard of that. Tell me about that, and what did that have to do with Queen Victoria?
In the early 17th century, I think. Sir Christopher Wren was an architect who believed that cemeteries should not be so perfectly quadranted off. They should have a more natural, flowing design. I think it's a very modern concept of returning design elements to the earth. And so we get cemetery. He was the first to propose a cemetery that followed in that sort of design concept. So his thought process dovetailed nicely with what was happening in the Victorian era with what they would have called modern concepts of death. So before then, cemeteries were kind of forlorn places that you only visited when someone died. You performed the funeral and then you moved on, and they were not very well taken care of. The headstones would fall over, the monuments would fall over. Often people would be found sleeping in the cemetery. Folks used to gamble in cemeteries. Illicit behavior took place in cemeteries. Sometimes people lay, yeah, right. Sometimes, I know that things have changed so much. Folks would let their wildlife, or their livestock rather, roam in the cemetery, and so they weren't beloved places. They weren't important. And Queen Victoria, when she lost her husband Albert, went into mourning famously for the rest of her life and wore widow's weeds for decades. She also sort of helped to herald in a new age of mourning. She is credited with changing the style of headstones to less bleak or drab and more heavenly, more uplifting, encouraging you. So for instance, in Elmwood, we have a lot of obelisks that are the tall, pointy structures that are thin. Okay, first of all, they are found in Egypt a lot. The Victorians loved their Egyptology. But also, it encourages you to look up toward heaven. There are a lot of angels in the cemetery with fingers pointed up toward the sky. That's because they want you to think of your heavenly reward. Think of your heavenly host, your heavenly father. There are a lot of flowers carved into the stones, and every flower for the Victorians had was symbolic of a different thing. So roses meant love, lilies meant purity, ivy represented everlasting life. So the rural cemetery movement did all of that. The rural cemetery movement helped people sort of cope with death, and when you have a cemetery that's designed with all of these, you know, rolling path, these rolling hills and winding pathways for carriages, Elmwood used to even have bandstands throughout the property because the cemetery founders would have bands to come in and play on Saturdays and Sunday afternoons. So what does that do? But it becomes an early park for the citizens, and they come in and they enjoy it like a park.
In the 1900s, so 1870, 1880, 1900s, we had about 40 bands in the city of Memphis. Everybody had a band.
Yeah.
The telegraph operators had one. The postal boys had one. There were private bands. And there were bands everywhere because, well, we had a lot of parades back in the day, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
But afternoon band concerts on Saturdays and Sundays, that was a big thing.
Right. I mean, that was people's entertainment back then. And I always think about, you know, when people have said, gosh, it's hard to think that there would be, you know, a bandstand in the cemetery. But these cemeteries were meant for the living. That was the thing. It was, you know, certainly for the deceased, but really for the living. And that's why the streetcar line ran out here. That's why people came out and had picnics on Saturdays and Sundays and tended their people's graves. And it was no longer a place like, you know, before the rural cemetery movement, before the Victorians, you know, you'd see skulls and crossbones on headstones. You didn't see that anymore. This was a thing. It was like a celebration of your life. And if you were a Christian, then of course you've gone on to your reward. So that's the way they looked at that. And I just think that's fascinating. And really, before Memphis had parks, we didn't have like a real park till 1901. Designed Overton Park. I mean, we had public spaces that people used, but you know, you can imagine how just park space like this was so important to people. I mean, when people lived, there were a lot of tenements downtown. There were just a jumble of buildings and shacks and shanties around, and you are not living your best life standing out in your muddy yard, you know. And so
where
to
your
come,
privy was in the back part of your house,
exactly.
And you were elbow to elbow with everybody living next to you, and people threw trash in the street, and there was standing water everywhere. It was not a clean living.
Yeah.
So getting out to the countryside was seen as a way to escape all of that disease And frankly, there was more death in the city than there was in the countryside.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
who was the first person buried here?
First person to be buried here was Mrs. R.B. Berry. Her name was Mary Markham Berry. And she was buried in July of 1853. Her story is kind of, when I'm telling young women especially, the story of, you know, women's history in Memphis and the world and Elmwood on those tours, I always like to include Mrs. Berry because she didn't really get her fair shake in the Memphis story for a long time. You know, she was a young woman when she married. She was the second wife of a doctor, and when she married him, he already had 7 children. She had to help him raise them. She only had 1 child of her own, who later died from yellow fever, and she died too. And they're both buried here. But for the reason I bring her up is because for many years, we just called her Mrs. Dr. R.B. Berry. She went by her husband's name, and she had her own name.
Yeah.
So she's buried in the Chapel Hill section of the cemetery, and beautiful, you know, tablet style marker in the oldest part of the cemetery.
Tell me about the Union soldiers being moved.
Sure. So Elmwood has tons of Civil War history found in the cemetery, Union and Confederate, both. We have, you know, over 20 Confederate generals. We've got over 1,000 Confederate veterans buried here. We've even got 2 Union generals buried here. There used to be over 700 Union soldiers buried here. And they're not buried here anymore. Well, what happened? Well, after the Civil War was over, well, first of all, they were buried here during the Civil War. Of course, the Battle of Memphis was not when all the great loss of life. The people who were buried here were brought in by train from other battle sites. They were buried on the no man's land before it became no man's land. But then after the Civil War was over, the National Cemetery Service was started. And that meant that all of the Union soldiers who were buried in cemeteries like Elmwood throughout the South were disinterred and moved to national cemeteries. This is when they began. When they were disinterred from Elmwood, the person who was in charge of the operation came over, brought up all the caskets, and tried to keep them married to their headstone by writing their name on the side of their casket in chalk. And the night before they were scheduled to be moved from Elmwood to the National Cemetery on Jackson Avenue, it rained, and all but 11 names washed off the caskets. And so when you visit that cemetery, you will find an inordinately high number of Union soldiers who were unknowns buried there. They have the second highest concentration of unknown Union soldiers in the United States, only outside of Arlington National Cemetery because of that reason.
What's the connection between Elmwood and the Sultana?
The connection to Elmwood and the Sultana. Honey, help me out with this story. So yeah. The Sultana was a steamboat.
Yes, I mean, it was a kind of classic, you know, big packet boat, and it just ran up and down the river doing everything. I mean, they would, Memphis was a big grocery town. We don't talk about that a lot, but all of the plantations, you know, along the river and down in the Delta, anywhere the train lines went, all of the plantations were supplied by these big grocery companies. And so you see a lot of the fortunes that came to be in Memphis, a lot of those people made their money in groceries, because what would happen is they would have these groceries, and of course, you know, you get paid once a year when you gin your cotton, right? So in October and November, people were getting their money, and then they'd pay back anybody who gave them the money, you know, to make a crop. Generally, you know, every plantation had what they called a commissary. It was their own store. And if you worked on a big plantation down in outside Clarksdale or somewhere, you had to buy from the commissary.
And we call that the company store.
That's the company store. That's exactly right. If you were a coal miner up in Kentucky or Pennsylvania, you did the same thing. You bought from it. And a lot of those people paid off in their own coins, their own script. They called it, down in the Delta, they called it brozine. And I don't know where that comes from, but it was, you know, I've seen coins. And so, you know, you get paid off and you get your money from the Stovall plantation or wherever, and you go up to the store and then you can buy what you need. Well, to get all those groceries down there, they either went on the train or on packet boats. And this little packet boats were running up, you know, all the little rivers, the Yazoo River, the Sunflower, you know, the Red River, all that. But so the Sultana was just one of those. It was just like we see trucking companies, you know. And so at the end of the war, the United States government, you know, put out a call because you had tens of thousands of people displaced. You had so many people, say, in the Andersonville prisoner of war camp over in Georgia. How do you get these people back to Indiana and Pennsylvania? So they, you know, the logistics were just must have been a nightmare. Well, the way they got a lot of those people from Andersonville, they put them on trains and took them over to New Orleans. Then from New Orleans, you took a boat up somewhere. So the people who owned, the call went out, and I forget exactly, Kim, what it was, but it was per head.
Yeah, it was like $5 per enlisted man.
Yeah.
Maybe $10 or $12 per ranking officer.
For officer,
to transport them home.
Right.
And so the people, anybody who owned a way to transport people took advantage of this, obviously, because at the end of the war, nobody had any money and the government was promising good money.
Right, and the infrastructure was completely devastated. You know, I mean, I find it strange that there were any railroad tracks left because they had been blown up and pulled up and all that stuff. It was a mess. These people got over to New Orleans, and the Sultan is sitting there. Many other boats were sitting there, and they started loading people on. And the Sultan, I think, was...
It was slated for 376 passengers.
Okay, 376 passengers. They put over 1,700 people on that boat, if you can imagine.
And livestock.
Livestock and groceries. And, I mean, they had to feed everybody and all this. It was just a mess. So they start chugging up the Mississippi River. Of course, it's in April. The river is at its highest of the year. The river is still cold. You got all of them. And moving very, very fast. So they are chugging as well as they could. They had to stop. They had problems with the boiler. They had to stop, I think, in Natchez and then again in Vicksburg. They even put more people on in Vicksburg.
Put a patch on the boiler.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so everywhere they stopped, they would have to do some kind of maintenance. They stopped in Helena, and there, you've only ever seen two pictures of the Sultana. And one of them is taken by a photographer in Helena. And somebody said, hey, a photographer's standing over there on the bank. So, of course, this guy's standing there with a big view camera. And, okay, say you've been in Andersonville for 2 years as a prisoner. Your people aren't sure if you're alive or not. You know, how do you get at least the opportunity for somebody to see that you're alive? You want your picture on a newspaper page or something like that. So everybody went over to that side of the ship, and the Sultana almost capsized in Helena. So they finally got everybody kind of straightened around, and they chugged on up to Memphis, loaded some more stuff, more coal and everything in Memphis. And then I think they were about 10 miles north of Memphis and at night, and the boiler blew. And they said that bodies floated by Memphis for days.
Yeah.
How many people were killed?
Most of them.
Yeah.
I would say that the overwhelming majority of people, and if you weren't killed by the steam blast,
right,
then you were killed by, if you weren't killed by the fire,
yeah,
then you were killed by jumping into the Mississippi River, which would have been exceptionally cold at that time.
That's right.
So very few people survived it. Those who did not survive were brought out to Elmwood and buried on a lot of Sultana victims, four Sultana victims. We still have three Sultana victims buried at Elmwood. Esther and Susan Spikes, a mother and daughter, are buried here. And I believe his name is George Slater. He was a man who worked on board the ship. Those three are buried here. And then, of course, all the Union soldiers were disinterred and moved out to the National Cemetery. But, you know, the Sultana, the reason we talk about the Sultana, the reason that we were asked this question, which is very important, was that there was a greater loss of life in the explosion of the Sultana than loss of life of the Titanic.
Yeah.
But we don't talk about it. Why didn't we talk about it? The reason we didn't was because it was the end of the Civil War. And just a few days before the Sultana blew, the president had been assassinated. This took over the headlines. It was all anybody could talk about. I can't imagine the chaos that would have been going through everybody's head in the United States at that time. You know, the war has ended. What's going to happen? There's no blueprint for this. What day-to-day life would have been like. The president's dead, and that's all they could sort of focus on. And so, of course, the Sultana got overshadowed. It was written about in one newspaper that I can think of. It got about 2 column inches for the old newspaper people. And the rest has been patchworked back together by historians.
Yeah.
A couple books have been written about it.
Sure.
Fascinating.
You know, and a funny thing is that I think it was maybe the New York Times or somebody covered it, but it was on like the fifth page or something. You know, so people say, well, why didn't the Memphis papers cover the Sultana? You know, it's the greatest loss of life ever in American history. Well, you got to think about this. The appeal which they called the moving appeal back then. The appeal had left Memphis a couple of years before, and they were, you know, they put the press on a train car.
Like John Reed McClanahan and put it on and rolled it around the South. That's
exactly.
Right.
You know,
he was in Grenada for a while.
He was. And then
he moved to Columbus or somewhere
else. Yeah, and then over to Montgomery. Yeah, so he was.
Citizens never knew.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't know where it was been.
Right.
But he had to hide from the Yankees.
And so, you know, I mean, everything had been disrupted. Everything had been disrupted. I can't imagine what that time would have been like. But so I'm glad we remember the Sultana, and I'm glad we remember, like, the chaos that was going on in that time. And those are the reasons where we don't know a whole lot about it.
What about scandals and scoundrels? Who was the most notorious of Elmwood residents?
Most notorious residents of Elmwood. We do an entire tour called Scandals and Scoundrels of the Cemetery. So we call this our gossip tour of the cemetery. You know, just because you've passed away doesn't mean we're going to quit talking about you. And that's probably the highest compliment I can give anybody. I hope people are in the least bit interested in my life when I pass away, but probably won't be. Maybe. Anyway, so some of the most notorious residents, I would have to say Alma Theed is one of them. She was convicted of killing 3 husbands. She married 7 of them. Of course, 2 of them were remarriages. So I don't know how that math bears out.
Hey everybody, Mark here. We're going to take a quick break while that train goes by. It makes a lot of noise. I wanted to thank some of the sponsors for this year. We're recording this at the end of 2019. I just wanted to kind of call out a few people that have been very helpful to the show. Obviously, Kim and Willie at Elmwood, a pleasure spending time with them. Wayne Dowdy over at the Memphis Room at the Memphis Public Library, 3030 Poplar. Always been a big fan of the show and a friend. We appreciate that. The fine staff at Pink Palace, which we've done a couple of episodes there. Nura and also Steve, who's the executive director there. And then Mark Fleischer with Storyboard Memphis. Big fans of the show and vice versa. We love that publication. Get a copy of that wherever you can. And let's get back to the show.
So Alma Theed, one of her stories that I like the best was she was convicted of killing one of her husbands. He was twice her age, and he was 56 when she killed him. She and a former horse jockey named Charles Miller were convicted of killing him. And the reason she gave for killing him was she was bored of him. She just got tired of him because he was boring. And she wanted to live a faster life. Her name, colloquially, she was known as Vance Avenue Elma. And she got her name from frequenting the bars and bordellos along Vance Avenue. So you can do the math there and figure out what kind of person she was. But she's just one of them. She's pretty notorious, though, I think. And then, you know, I would say Jenny Moon is another one. She's on the Scandals and Scoundrels tour. Her name was Virginia Bethel Moon, and she was a young woman in boarding school in Ohio when the Civil War broke out. And she was a Confederate sympathizer and wanted desperately to come back home to her father's farm in Whitehaven and contribute what she could to the Southern cause. And so she wrote to her mother and asked if she could leave, and her mother told her she may not. And then so Jenny went into the headmaster's room, stole her pistol, went out into the schoolyard and shot the stars out of the American flag. So then she was summarily dismissed from school, came back home. While she had tried to gather up letters of sympathy and medicines to bring back home with her. She even had a pistol, a shotgun.
A musket,
forgive me. I'm not very good at gun things.
Yeah.
Thanks, honey. She shoved it down the back of her dress. Now, Southern women were known for their posture, their very good posture, but this was a bit ridiculous. So when she got to Cincinnati, she was caught, and she was sent to Memphis with an escort and made to check in with the general in charge of the occupation of Memphis at that time. I think his name was Hurlbut. She had to check in with him every single day for something like 3 months. It was a long time. Finally, at the end of her sort of house arrest, he said, "Jenny, go home. I don't want to hear from you again. Do not get any more trouble." Well, immediately she went home. thought that wasn't good enough, crossed into Mississippi territory and began spying on the movements of Union troops. She wasn't very good at it. Here's the thing, she was very conspicuous, she was a pretty girl, and so she attracted attention naturally. She did get caught a lot, and she was jailed a lot. She flirted her way out of jail a number of times, was said to have had 17 fiancés at the end of it all. You know, when the war ended...
She was a working girl.
She was. She worked really hard. And then at the end of the war, she, you know, went back to her father's farm, lived there for a while, ran the house as a boarding house, went and then at some point went and lived in Greenwich Village, on the outskirts of Greenwich Village, and starred in a couple, well, not starred in, appeared in a handful of silent movies, including Robin Hood, but with Douglas Fairbanks. When she died, she was cremated, and her ashes were brought back to Elmwood, and so she's buried here. That's just two.
That's great. Talk about Finest Bates. I think that's one of the most fascinating.
Finest is a good story, I have to admit. He is the grand... First, I'll start by saying that he is the grandfather of Kathy Bates, the actress. And so I feel like I know Kathy personally.
You should.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we're just good friends. No, I'm just kidding. We are related by Elmwood. But anyway, Finest lived at 1234 Harbert Avenue. That was his address. And he was a lawyer by trade, but what his obsession was with this mummy that he owned. It was a mummified human being that he kept in his garage, that he worked to convince other people that it was the mummy of John Wilkes Booth. Now, how did he get to this conclusion? Well, he had, and a number of people convinced themselves, and I know this would never happen today. We would never let the truth get in the way of a good story today, right?
No.
Exactly. We just go with the good story.
Right.
People are not easily swayed, never have been. So anyway, he like many others, bought into a conspiracy theory after the Civil War that John Wilkes Booth was not shot in that barn where he was cornered, but instead escaped and was able to live on the lam as a common day laborer in the Midwest for many years, going by several other names. I can't remember what they are right now, but it's a fantastic story with a capital F. He collected affidavits of, and when I say he, I mean Mr. Bates, collected affidavits of people who swore that they knew this man and swore that he said he was John Wilkes Booth. The mummy was just sort of a thing that he showed people, and when he died, the mummy was sold to a traveling circus and was never seen again. I'm convinced that the thing... crumbled after being handled so many times.
I think you're right, yeah.
But yeah, so.
Yeah, somewhere between Sheboygan and,
right.
and Milwaukee or something. Yeah, right.
Right.
It just turned
exactly.
to dust.
Exactly. I'm sure yeah. it did. So Finest is another one of them.
Yeah.
We've got people buried here who lived very big stories,
yeah.
who sort of stood out. But we also have a lot of people who are buried at Elmwood who are just ordinary people. You know, and they all weave together beautifully here. I mean, everybody contributes to the bottom line. Everybody contributes to the story, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
The first families of Memphis.
Sure, they are buried here as well. I like to tell people that all the street names are buried here. So we have...
A bunch of them are.
Yes, they sure are. Not all of them, but most of them. We have the Trezevants, the Overtons, the Snowdens, I'm looking at Boss Crump's obelisk right now outside of the window where we're filming. Gosh, there's so many of them. I don't even know where to begin and end. And of course, that tradition continues. So, you know, we have, you know, Ben Hooks is buried here now. And we have Ernest Withers is buried here now. And the Judge Sugarman is buried here now, so we continue, you know, while we have the founding families of Memphis buried here, the history never stops.
Right.
So,
When did we start doing the segregation thing, you know? The other day at the Shelby County Historic Commission, we were talking about Zion Cemetery. Mm-hmm. Got it.
They're doing a great job over at Zion. I'm so impressed with the work that they've been doing, and they have started from nothing. So, I mean, and one of my coworkers is on their board of trustees, and they are very committed to helping that cemetery out. Bravo to them. But so Elmwood was segregated from its earliest days, just like the rest of the world. Everything in the South, I would say most of the United States, was segregated. What we found in the cemetery business is that people want to be buried with their own families and with their own people. So you want to be buried with, maybe in the old days, and when I say the old days, I mean the 1850s, maybe you want to be buried with not just your family, but also the people you went to church with, or the people that you lived around the corner from, or maybe just beloved friends. And so that's how sections of cemeteries self-perpetuate. It's not as common today. Of course, the cemetery is totally desegregated. Anybody can be buried anywhere, of course. But we still have some sections of the cemetery. Like, we have a Chinese section of the cemetery. That's where the Chinese families are buried. And they keep up with their history. And they're very, you know, the Lung Kong Ten Yi Association is very active. They just had a historic marker installed on Beale Street. So we still have sections in the cemetery. So did I answer your question? Kinda, maybe, sorta.
Kinda, sorta, maybe. Because okay. My next question pertains to ethnic.
A lot of ethnic. Basically, I like to tell people that if your family came through the South or through Memphis at any time in Memphis's history, you're probably represented here at Elmwood. So we have people from all walks of life buried here. Like I mentioned just now, Chinese. We've also got a Greek section. We've got a German section, an Irish section. We've got African American section. We've got Romani buried at the cemetery. Now, some people call Romani gypsies. I think that they call themselves gypsies, and that's it's just kind of that term has been seen one way or the other over the years. But I will go with what they call themselves. I know many of them, and they have a long history of being buried at Elmwood. Now, the Protestant gypsies are buried at Elmwood. The Catholic gypsies are buried across the interstate at Calvary Cemetery. And then we've just got, now we're seeing some Hispanics moved into the cemetery. We have a new Jewish area of the cemetery. We have, we've got some Muslim people buried here at Elmwood. And so it really is open to all. This was the non-sectarian cemetery of Elmwood, of Memphis, rather.
Particularly of interest to me is our police and fire. And I know when William Blakemore was killed at his funeral, which was wonderful, they brought him here, which I thought was...
It was a beautiful service. Yeah, that was a really beautiful service. I was on staff when that happened. He's buried near the Neptune side of the cemetery, on the west side of the cemetery, and he died in the line of duty. It was very tragic. They brought fire trucks out to the cemetery, and it was huge. We designated that area where he's buried the police and firefighter section. And we committed ourselves to, if any one of these men or women dies in the line of duty, they would be given a free burial space at Elmwood. So it is still there, still available to anybody. We hope nobody ever needs it again, but it is available to those who need it.
You know, and it is nice that y'all have done that.
Thank you. We have several Mason's lots here at Elmwood, and one of which is located right behind the office where I get to work. And let me just say, I work in the most beautiful place in Memphis, in the most beautiful office in Memphis. I love my job and where I get to work. But anyway, the Masons are buried behind our office, and there are hundreds of them. Nearby, we have the Oddfellows lot, and the Oddfellows is a group of... You might think, well, that's a very strange name for a group of people. Yes, some might say it was odd. The Oddfellows was a group of men, laborers, who banded together in the early 1800s, late 1700s, sometime in there, I'm unsure of the year, somebody out there will correct me on that, and they decided that they wanted to get together and have their own Masonic type group. Usually Masonic groups were reserved for one type of person. Well, they decided that maybe they couldn't pay as high dues as Masons would have paid. So maybe they paid less, but they worked in numbers, and a newspaper in England referred to them as those Odd Fellows. And so the name stuck and they became known as the Odd Fellows, which I think is great. We have a lot of containing Mason Odd Fellows burials here at Elmwood, and it's near the office as well. You know, that's part of that original 40-acre purchase over there. So a lot of the early Memphis history, if you ever visit Elmwood, is on the east side of the interstate side. It's all over the cemetery. You can find it everywhere, but the east side that's the oldest part. So
they were heavily involved in the building of various structures. They were a major player in Porter Leith, which is another subject.
That's right, I forgot about that. That's right, they sure were.
Well, and I think just kind of in general, there were a lot of fraternal organizations, you know, and those organizations, people got together, they wanted to make a club, and generally what you would do is part of your dues would go to pay for your burial plot. And, you know, you look around, you see a lot of, if you see these stones that look like logs, those are from the Woodmen of the World, which was another fraternal organization.
We had certain groups of people were not allowed to be in certain groups.
Right, exactly.
The caste system in Memphis, Tennessee was horrible.
Yeah.
That's a subject we could talk on for days.
True.
Yeah.
We had groups of Germans that banded together and Irish that banded together, and right. Not all of these were Masons.
Yeah, we have the Knights of Pythias down here, which was another, you know, fraternal organization. I think you see a lot of those groups here. But what they did is they understood that there's kind of strength in numbers. And like you say, with Porter Leith and things like that, you know, you go together, everybody puts their little bit in, and you can create something. And then when you die, you get a headstone and a place to be buried for you and your spouse. So,
well, you
talk
about the civil rights pioneers.
Yeah, you know, I just in the last few years, I mean, there have always been civil rights pioneers here. The Church families buried here. Robert Church was the first African-American millionaire in the South. And he really helped bring Memphis back after Memphis lost its charter in the late 1870s. And he really did a lot for this town. And then, of course, his son, Robert Church Jr., you know, came along and he was also very involved in politics. Robert Church Jr. was a very important part of the Republican Party in the teens and the 1920s and up through the 30s. I mean, he was always a delegate, which was odd for an African American person from Memphis, you know. So the Church family's always been involved, you know, in civil rights.
He was one of the
rights.
Founders of the Lincoln League.
That's right.
He was big time in it.
That's right. That's right. And then, you know, you get more in what we refer to as the modern civil rights movement, you know, the civil rights movement from the late 50s and through the 60s. You know, I'm looking right out here at the final resting place of Maxine and Vasco Smith. And, you know, Vasco Smith was on the county commission for many years. Maxine Smith was the first African-American on the Shelby County School Board. And so all of these things, all of these people kind of stepped out and, you know, they were educated. I mean, Maxine Smith tried to go to college at Memphis State University at the time. They wouldn't let her in. She already had a degree from, I think she went to Radcliffe or somewhere like that, but they wouldn't let her in. So, you know, you start looking at these things and you see why people just started that march to freedom. And so Judge Russell Sugarman was just buried here several months ago.
One of my personal heroes.
Yes, absolutely.
Can't say enough.
Yeah, just a wonderful man. And, you know, and all these people who could have just said, well, you know, I've got my position, I've got my law firm, I've got my dental practice, whatever they had, because they were all kind of all well set. But they all also said, I'm going to help the people who have nothing. And so, you know, kind of standing up against the powers that be in Memphis in the late 1960s and early 70s was a big deal. So there's a huge part of the civil rights story that's evident here at Elmwood.
Would y'all talk about the people in the music business that are tied to us here?
Yeah, you know, a few years ago we started, you know, just kind of being here at the cemetery, knowing a lot of the residents here. I made a film about Elmwood in 2002, and at that time I found out that Jimmy Lunsford was buried here. Jimmy Lunsford's the big band leader. He started off as a football coach at Manassas High School. He then went to the principal and said, "Listen, I'll keep coaching football, but also can I start a band?" And that really started the tradition of excellence in the music program at Manassas High School. And then, you know, other people, Herman Frank Arnold, who wrote Dixie, the song Dixie, and that was played at Jefferson Davis's inaugural in Montgomery, Alabama in 1861. You know, he's buried here. I knew that Ma Rainey, too, was buried here. She's buried right over there. I'm looking over at her place right now. And she used to play down at Blues Alley on Front Street in Memphis. So I knew all those people, but then I started looking at people who have died in just the past very few years. And some of them were friends of mine. I know everybody's heard of Diane Price, who's the blues pianist. Diane Price and her boyfriends. Diane Price is buried here. Sid Selvidge, who was a folk singer and a writer. He taught at Rhodes College. He started Beale Street Caravan, which is the internationally syndicated program that comes out of Memphis on the radio. And Sid Selvidge is buried here. He was one of the prime movers in going out and finding the old blues men back in the 60s and all this. They kind of discovered Furry Lewis and Booker White and people like that. And then John Hampton, who was a producer and engineer at Arden Recording. When we do the music tour here, I take a Bluetooth speaker around with us, and we play these people's music. So when we get to John Hampton's gravesite, I play Jimmy and Stevie Ray Vaughan. I mean, some of the best music that happened in the 1990s and the early 2000s, the Gin Blossoms and all of these people that John Hampton produced. He won 2 Grammy Awards. And so, you know, there are just so many people. Wayne Jackson, who played trumpet in the Memphis Horns. The Memphis Horns played on every Otis Redding song ever recorded. I mean, you think about
Peter
that.
Gabriel, U2, Elvis Presley.
That's right.
I don't even know.
He played on Suspicious Minds for Elvis Presley. You know, when you think about Neil Diamond, Sweet Caroline. Bum, bum, bum. You know who played that bum, bum, bum? That was Wayne Jackson. You know, so you look at all the, his wife Amy comes with us usually on the music tour, and she talks about her husband. And he played on well over 100 top 10 hits. I mean, think about that, right here in Memphis and right here in Elmwood. Now, so there's a real tradition of music people being buried here.
And so this leads me to my next question of how do you find the stories to tell?
You know, I think just looking around and just kind of knowing Memphis and knowing, you know, who people are and what contributions they've made, it's a fascinating thing to put those things together.
That's part of it. The other part of it is that I'm going to toot the horn of my staff. You know, the most important ingredient for finding stories about people and learning their history is to listen to them talk, and to meet with them and sit with them or listen to their families talk about them. You know, when they come in to do business with us on the business end of Elmwood, which is, you know, the sad fact of life, we are receptive to those stories in a way that I think not so very many people are. And, you know, that's really where it comes from, is being open. You know, but also I will say this, I've got a historian on staff whose job it is to look backward. And she goes through our files and our archives and finds interesting new facts about people. And, you know, we're finding people all the time, and we are now able, you know, we've got this great thing called the internet. And so, like, we can expand upon their stories in ways we probably never could have before.
But I think that the staff here at Elmwood possesses the context, too. I mean, you know, you've got to know some things to be able to connect the dots.
And yeah, you have volunteers here. I know Vincent Astor spends a lot of time here, and he's very knowledgeable.
Yes, absolutely.
A real go-to guy for us. What we do. And you have other people I know, Harrison.
Yes, Donald Harrison is a wonderful addition. We've got a lot of volunteers you may not have met yet who are wonderful too, who are equally as interested in other stories that may not have been really expanded upon yet. People are always coming on board our volunteer crew and getting interested, getting bit by a certain part of history, if you will. So, we've got some really great volunteers who help us out a lot.
What events have you developed over the years that bring people here? And this goes with, this also goes with the future, and it also goes with the most important question here, and that's the one about, you and I talked the other day about this outdoor museum, which I think is such a great thing. How does all that play together?
Yeah. Over the years, we've developed many different kinds of tours. None of this would have happened without the contributions of many families who stepped forward in the mid-1990s to 2000s to help shore up the cemetery financially. Once they did that, we were able to do so much better work over here at Elmwood, I think. And so it enabled us to look back ever more and find stories in our archives. I've been able to create many different kinds of tours at the Elmwood. They're all thematic. So we began, of course, with the Elmwood 101 tour years ago. And then we created other tours, like the Women of Elmwood tour, Scandals and Scoundrels that we talked about a little while ago, Pawing Through History, which is a pet tour of the cemetery. Over the past couple of months, we have developed the Upstanders tour, that's a civil rights tour of the cemetery. We have developed the Stories in Stone, which is a symbolism tour of the cemetery. Last week, we gave for the first time ever the Tombs in Transit, which is a tour of the Winchester Cemetery as it relates to Elmwood. So it's and further stories of people who get moved around after death, and that was a very interesting tour. We recently put together, we have a tree tour because we're a level 3 arboretum, so we have 90 different species of trees here on the grounds. And several times a year, we offer a guided tree tour at the cemetery. We have an audio tour that Willie and I recently, well, I say recently, it was like 3 years ago, feels recent. Willie and I reworked together and had narrated by Dan Conaway. So people can come in, though we specifically did this for people who have mobility issues, people who couldn't do the hour and a half walk around the cemetery grounds. Well, you have a audio tour that you can take. From the comfort of your car. We do lectures in the chapel. So sometimes I bring in guest speakers. Sometimes I'm the guest speaker. So we have a lot of different events that take place indoors and out in the cemetery. And all of the, and many of them, there's an admission fee too. And we do that because Elmwood is a historic nonprofit cemetery. How did Elmwood come to be a nonprofit organization? To tell you the truth, I'm not totally sure, but it happened a very, very long time ago, well over a century ago, and so we are. And we have to raise money for the cemetery all the time to take care of cutting the grass, to take care of trimming the trees. Anything that we can do to offset those bills, we will do. And so it is our pleasure to have fundraising events here at Elmwood. recently, within the last couple of years, we have developed the Cemetery Cinema Series, which is exactly what it sounds like. We show movies in the cemetery, and we broadcast them out in the front of the cemetery near the office, and people sit on, they bring their lawn chairs, and they sit on the driveway, and we project the movie onto the, I know this sounds crazy, but we project it onto the roof of the cottage. And, you know, we sell those events out every single time we have one. We typically sell 300 tickets to them. All of these things help the cemetery function. A cemetery is no good if people are not visiting it. It's just sleepy, and it's alone, and it's lonely. A cemetery needs people in it, needs people to visit it. And so we try to make it as accessible as possible.
Well, you're going to have the next band concert.
The next band concert.
Like a high school band?
Well, I'll tell you, that's funny that you asked me that question, because I was contacted by somebody just today. Well, no, that's not a band concert. That was a production of Spoon River Anthology. A high school student wants to do Spoon River Anthology here, which is great. We've had Beethoven Club concerts here this past summer. We just did our last one. The Victorian Christmas Carols event is coming up on December 12th, where we're going to do the history of Victorian Christmas Carols, when they were written. Some of these things that we still sing today were written in the 15th century. It's amazing. Wow. And we're going to do that in this building, and we're going to swap postcards.
Are y'all two going to sing?
No, but you don't want. Willie can sing. I can't sing.
We're going to play our ukuleles.
Yes, we're going to play our ukuleles. Yes. No, we are not going to do that. No, St. Mary's Cathedral is bringing people to sing for that from their choir, and Dennis Janzer, who is the director of music, is going to play piano that night. So we will have music in here for Christmas, yeah. And I'm so happy for
what
that.
What was the thing that we had that Dennis came and brought the two singers? This was back maybe in August.
Yes, that was for the Yellow Fever production.
Yes, right.
It sure was, and it was lovely. And we're going to do that same format again for the Victorian Christmas Carols. Okay. We're going to get a Christmas tree for the chapel.
Yeah.
And we're going to have wassail and a sing-along, and we're going to have lights and candles. It's going to be really lovely.
Yeah.
Thursday, December 12th.
Well, you know, and I will say this, it's amazing how quickly these things sell out. You know, I mean, if you don't know about these things, you think, would people come out to a cemetery? Let me tell you, when they do something like this, they always sell out. So whether it's a movie or whether it's tours or lectures in here or music events in here, it's amazing how many people come, because once you come, you're going to come back.
That's right.
I want to thank you both for taking your time with us. I think this has been a wonderful experience. I've already taken about three or four little things that I'm going to delve off into research on. And thanks again for your time.
Thanks for having us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode. We want to thank Kim and Willie for their help here and their stories. It was wonderful. Check out our website show notes for links to elmwoodcemetery.org, and for everybody that couldn't wait to hear that train whistle, here it is.